Our guest this hour found himself far away from his native America, confronted by a harsh reality in someone else's life. James Hopkins could not turn away. He found a way to help the poor Indian women of Kathmandu, Nepal, and to help their children go to school as well. His creation is called Quilts for Kids Nepal, and we'll spend our time together talking about motivations and mechanisms. James Hopkins is visiting the region to speak about his ongoing project, and he's here in the studio with us. James Hopkins, welcome.
Good to be here.
You had a whole career already, far removed in place and in action from Nepal. What was that?
I worked for more than 20 years as an investment broker. I worked for Payne Webber, which later became UBS. Started out on Wall Street in New York City and kept working with them for a long time. So quite different from where I ended up.
Did you just retire? Did you get out of the life because you'd made enough money or just didn't like it anymore or some combination thereof?
It was kind of a combination of both of those things. Somewhere when I was in my mid-30s, I started traveling and found myself in India and was so impressed by what I saw there in terms of the way that people were able to have a sort of spiritual life, a meaningful life, and continued to come back to India and Nepal and Tibet every year, and finally just sort of thought I'd like to live there and step outside of the system that grew up in the U.S. And it took some time to figure out how to do that, but worked it out.
I can imagine that after you've spent a fair amount of time in that part of the world, that when you come back to what you've characterized as, you know, this is my place in the world here on Wall Street, that did it just begin to look very, very different over time?
It began to certain aspects of living in the U.S. Started to be a little bit more difficult to handle. I remember the first time I went to India and had my eyes open to how difficult life was there and spent some time backpacking around in these sort of rough areas. And when I came back to the U.S., I slept on the floor for about 3 weeks. I just couldn't get back into my bed. So, you know, certain comforts seemed very difficult to go back into it even.
And so do you live there full time in that part of the world now?
I do now. I've lived in Kathmandu for 11 years now. Yeah.
And what was it that made that the choice of the place to settle?
Well, it was actually quite mathematical. My girlfriend and I decided that we wanted to leave the U.S. and just go somewhere different to have an extraordinary life. And so one night, literally, we wrote the names of all the cities that we thought we might like to live on a piece of paper in a column, and then wrote rows across the top of sort of the things that we thought might make a meaningful life. Friends, good food, access to spirituality, good light, things like that. And we just assigned numbers in a grid work and we did the math. And in the end, the city that won was a city that was about an hour away from where I grew up. And so immediately we canceled that idea. And the next city was Kathmandu. So we just said, let's go live in Kathmandu.
So what was the city that rose above Kathmandu?
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Really?
Which these days actually ends up on everyone's sort of top 10 list as a great place to live. And it is, but a little too close to home.
That's interesting. Access to spirituality was one of the things that was a must-have on that list, as opposed to, you know, access to entertainment or, you know, close to public transportation or something. Access to spirituality is an interesting one to put on that list.
Well, I think what one notices, or what I noticed at least, when traveling to the other half of the planet, you can say to the Asian side, is that spirituality is so present in daily life. There's no separation between what you do, who you are, what you do for a living, and your religious life. When you walk around the streets in Kathmandu or in anywhere in India, everyone is making offerings at small temples. Everyone's day starts with some kind of offering and some kind of religious practice, from school kids to old people. It's an integral part, and I was really taken by that aspect of life and how it seemed to make people's lives much more meaningful, much more rich, and I just was drawn to it and wanted to have that myself.
Is there anything to compare it to in American cities?
Wow, that's a
even Charlottesville.
I think we have a devotion to a lot of things here in the West that we have a lot of devotion to the type of food that we eat and where we have kind of temples to food and
We have devotion. It's just not spiritual devotion.
Yeah. We have a lot of devotion, a lot of rituals, and a lot of very disciplined practices, but they don't always end up in a spiritual way.
We have much more to talk about with James Hopkins. We barely scratched the surface of what he's doing in Nepal and about Quilts for Kids Nepal. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, talk more with James about what he's doing, and take your questions and comments if you'd like to join us by phone or by email. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with James Hopkins and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is James Hopkins. He's the founder of something called Quilts for Kids Nepal. He decided he didn't want to live in America and, well, more appropriately, wanted to live in a different part of the world and gain some of the benefits of living in that part of the world, and ended up in Kathmandu and realized there are some people here who need help and I can provide that help. And so that's what's going on with Quilts for Kids in Nepal. We'll get into the mechanism in the moments ahead, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about it. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Check us out on Facebook. You can see a picture of James just before we got started here this morning. Was there a bit of a spiritual crisis? We talked about how you wanted access to spirituality in Kathmandu and the daily practices of people, many rituals, many devotions to their own spiritual or religious practices, very different from anything you see in America. But were you studying Buddhism? Is that what I understand?
No spiritual crisis per se, but I grew up in a very religious family, Christian, Presbyterian family, went to church every Sunday, enjoyed it quite a lot. And my father was an English professor at a school called Virginia Episcopal School. We went to chapel every morning. And even in college, I remember at one point I went to Duke University and they have a divinity school. I contemplated going to divinity school. So this kind of access to spirituality has always been fairly important. But it was traveling in Asia when I discovered a different kind of spirituality. It's one that seemed much more sort of appropriate in to my life and much more meaningful in that way. So when Kathmandu came up on the analysis of where to live in the world, I found that there was a school for foreign people where you could go and study in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. And I had some interest in Tibetan Buddhism, and so I said, let's go there. So actually ended up as a student in a traditional Tibetan monastery studying Tibetan language and Buddhist philosophy for the first 3 years of being in Kathmandu.
And was there some point, I'm just trying to figure out what the trigger was here. Was there a particular moment or a sequence of events that led to the creation of Quilts for Kids Nepal?
There was, in fact. Maybe it has a little bit to do with, you know, being an American where we always want to do things about what we believe in. But I remember sitting in class in the monastery school and the Lama is always talking about benefiting sentient beings, helping others. In fact, the entire focus of Vajrayana Buddhism is to benefit others and to help others. And kind of thought, well, what are you guys doing? I don't see it on the ground. I don't see the free clinics. I don't see feeding the poor, this kind of thing that we in the U.S. and specifically in America do so well. And so I kept bugging them. I kept bugging the lamas. You're always talking about Mother Teresa. There should be 1,000 Buddhist Mother Teresas. Where are they? And things like that. And really making a nuisance of myself.
So you challenged them quite a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And one day, the abbot of the monastery was giving a little talk. And I went up to him afterwards and again kind of challenged, you know, and said, you're talking about benefiting sentient beings. What do you really mean? And he said, not unkindly, but quite firmly, look, all I'm talking about is you have a certain set of skills. Just go outside. Whoever you see, you use those skills to help them. That's it. It's very simple. Parentheses, stop asking these kind of questions.
Right. You know? Yeah, the unsaid.
Yeah. So, you know, in Kathmandu, and especially in my neighborhood, there are a lot of beggars, a lot of street beggars, a lot of kids on the street, a lot of people who, that's their livelihood. So, and I've always sort of, I had always sort of ignored them. I've been kind to them, but never really sort of engaged. And that day I thought, okay, I'll do exactly what my Lama says. I walked out the door, and sure enough, one of these little girls came up and started talking with me, and I just decided to say yes to everything. Yes, gave a little donation. Would you like to have some tea with me? Yeah, sure. Would you like to come to my house? Yes. And I followed her down this path in a part of my neighborhood I'd never been to before, a little winding street past a dirt road, past a parrot that could talk, and kids screaming and running around. And then it came, suddenly there was a little encampment that I had never seen. There were about 500 people living in, we would say, a slum, houses made out of bamboo sticks covered with black plastic, and just hidden, like a little hidden village. And so I was really surprised, and she took me to her house, and her mom made lit a fire and made tea. And suddenly I was, I saw, how can I say, a side of life that I'd never seen. Very, very generous people, very kind people, people who I had sort of written off as the annoying people who are always asking you for money or, you know, trying to, you know, pretend like they're sad, and so you'll feel. But suddenly all that was dropped, and I was absolutely the most welcome guest that they had ever received. Food was being prepared. Tea was being served. Somebody wasn't eating so I could eat. And that was, yeah, kind of life-changing.
I can see how it would be. These are people that you really hadn't taken the time to notice before, and yet these are people who are incredibly generous of spirit and with what few material possessions they seem to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was so surprised that I thought, okay, this is where it happens. You know, what I've been told to do, take what you know, go out and help whoever you can. This is where it happens. So I hung around there for every day for about 3 months. And at first I was sort of saying, okay, I'm here to help, but I'm not giving anyone a cent, you know, a little bit prickly and, you know, defensive about, I'm not going to give anyone any money, but I'm going to help you people.
Were you afraid that once you gave any money, you'd end up giving it over and over and over and over again?
Just like that, or just a kind of still a kind of not trusting and not going with the flow of what was happening, actually. So I started helping people fix their houses, checking out their medicine. You know, people were taking vitamin C for tuberculosis and things. You know, the medical care was terrible there. They couldn't read the packages of medicine that they had just gotten from a pharmacy without seeing doctors. And so I was just sort of helping people with their houses and with medicine and trying to figure out what was going on. And one day I just noticed a woman was stitching together a beautiful, you would say, bed cover. Looked like a quilt, like my grandmother and her friends would make back in Virginia. Patchwork. And they use it to sort of sit on. They don't have, you know, beds and tables and proper furniture. We would say proper furniture. But they have a kind of platform that they cover with a beautiful bed cover. And I was watching her stitch that with so much skill, and I thought, oh, actually, something that woman is making something that we consider quite valuable in the West, and had the idea that if I could, you could say, create a market for that, if I could take that item back to the West and sell it for her, that she could make some money. So I took it back and sold it to my mom.
It's a good place to start.
Sure.
It's kind of like when you're selling candy bars for school. You start with your mom and your family first. We're talking to James Hopkins on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the founder of Quilts for Kids Nepal, and we're talking about the experiences that led to the formation of Quilts for Kids Nepal, which is actually a microfinance project with a couple of different beneficiaries. We'll talk more about that as we go along. You're welcome to join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org, or check us out on Facebook. So so you sold the first quilt to your mother, and then did you think, well, this is the beginning of something big? Before you even answer that question, did you go back to the abbot then and say, aha, I took your advice, and here's what happened?
No, I didn't do that. In fact, I felt as though I had received the lesson that I need to receive, and that was it, you know. But after I sold the quilt to mom for, I think, $140, I had that money in my hand, and I thought, well, you know, I don't know what to do with this money, and went back to the girl that had made me the tea, and I said, you know, I sold your sister's quilt, what can we do? And she said, well, my younger sister wants to go to school. She really wants to go to school and learn English. And this younger sister had been begging on the street, already started her begging career at age 7. And I thought, okay, great. So we took her by the hand down to a local school, 5 minutes walk away, and said, how much does it cost to go to school for a year? And the principal said, about $140. So kind of little light went off. And a very simple idea was born, and that is that these women were already making beautiful quilts, and if I could just simply connect them to generous people on the other side of the world, I would sell the quilts for the cost of sending one child to school for a year. And that's exactly what I started doing. And women would make quilts. I'd take them back and sell them to other relatives and friends. Come back with the money, enroll kids in school. And at first I was very hesitant to make it big. I didn't want to grow the project. I wanted to keep it very small. But today, 8 years later, we have 51 kids in school receiving full-time education and more than 20 women making quilts, earning a living for themselves, self-respect, and power in the community. And it is a project that just took on a life of its own.
So the schooling, let's get a little more context about why they're living in these conditions. These are Indian women living in Nepal, is that right?
It's a community of, you can say, almost gypsy-like, sort of a transitory community. Historically, they were sort of moving around a tribal region of India that's on the border of Pakistan, in the sort of Rajasthan and Punjab areas. It's a particular caste of people. And somewhere about 30 years ago, a few of these families came up to Kathmandu. And when I asked them why they came to Kathmandu, they say because it's cooler than the desert. And also more work. Means there's sort of more tourists or more people that they can. They've traditionally been a kind of begging caste. And so there were people they could beg from. So that started about 30 years ago, and relatives and friends in that community kind of migrated up. And now there are about 500 people from this Indian community living in Nepal. Nepal and India have a very porous border. People can work back and forth without papers, and so it's not surprising that they are having their own distinctly Indian desert community within the fabric of Kathmandu.
Is there any social safety net of any kind in Kathmandu and in Nepal generally that might be able to do things for them, or is it just not there, or do they not seek it out, or some combination?
Yeah, absolutely not. In fact, the fact that they are Indians and Nepal is not their home means that if there were a safety net for Nepalis, it would not be available to this group anyway. The school that the kids are attending is just a short walk away from this little encampment, And I had a hard time at first convincing the principal to allow these kids to come to school. You know, they don't have shoes, dirty, you know, they're not Nepali. And he was kindly sort of suggesting that I might use the generosity of the project to benefit Nepali kids and just let these Indian kids do what they were doing. And I kind of kindly suggested that that wasn't going to happen.
As long as everybody was kind, mm-hmm. that's the important thing.
And it has been a bit of an obstacle to get these kids from an untouchable caste into the Nepali system. But I have, you know, we foreigners have kind of special privileges in these communities sometimes. And because I was a foreigner and I had the funding and these kids and pushed a little bit, I was allowed to enroll the first few kids. Now we have about 25% of the entire school body comes from this one camp. So we have a little bit of power in the school now.
James Hopkins, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the founder of Quilts for Kids Nepal. He found a situation in front of him in Kathmandu where he lives and set about changing the situation. Is there any overt racism or nationalism that colors the situation between the Indians and the Nepalis?
There is, of course. Both Nepal and India are countries that historically have operated under the caste system. These days, the caste system is sort of technically illegal or, you know, not in place. But, of course, it's absolutely in place. When your last name is your caste, you're not – everyone knows
everybody
what
knows
caste.
Exactly right off the bat.
That's
you
right.
know, what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. It manifests in interesting ways. You know, kids are wonderful in that they don't really – participate in that so much. You know, they're just kids. They're free. They're open. They make friends easily. It's really us adults who kind of keep that system going. About 3 years ago, I was at Parents' Day at this school, and Parents' Day is basically an all-day performance of, you know, you can say karaoke acts, people dancing, kids dancing and singing to recorded music. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I noticed that my kids weren't participating. And then a kind of Bollywood number came on, you know, an Indian Hollywood, Bollywood film number came on. And I thought, oh, here, my kids will be up for this. That's their culture. And a group of Nepali kids came up and danced. And suddenly I realized my kids had not been allowed to participate. They hadn't been invited to be part of Parents' Day. And I, you know, manifested in my most sort of fierce American form and told the teacher, you know, I will absolutely take these kids out of school unless they have top billing next year. And so they did. In fact, the very next year, it was mostly my kids dancing to Nepali songs and wearing traditional Nepali clothing. I said, no, it's not like that. You know, they should just be allowed to participate in their traditional music in their traditional ways. So, you know, it manifests in kind of funny ways, but we have, I think, made a difference, Quilts for Kids, and our presence in this school and presence in this small community has started to make a little bit of difference in how people see these different cultures.
It's mentioned as a microfinance project. So is there some of your money involved in here up front or some mechanism to get money into the hands of the women to buy supplies or something?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Microfinance and microcredit is a fabulous way to change communities. I think more and more we all know that now. So the general model is women are given a $30 loan. And they use that money to go buy fabric to make their first quilt. And in fact, you can make three quilts with that amount of money. The women make these quilts from pieces of cloth that they either have around the house, sort of beg from tailor shops, or go purchase with this micro loan.
We need to take a pause there because sure. We're on the cusp of a break here, so let's go to one now. James Hopkins is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the founder of Quilts for Kids Nepal, taking women's handicrafts and sending their kids to school as two ends of the same transaction in Nepal for the last 8 years. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with James and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Check us out on Facebook as well. Back on the Exchange with James Hopkins and you in a minute 10. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is James Hopkins. He is a former Wall Street investment broker, now living in Kathmandu, India, and the founder of something called Quilts for Kids Nepal. He looked around and saw people in need in his immediate neighborhood and began to help them. And so the women in this Indian neighborhood in Kathmandu make quilts with the help of microfinance from the organization, and in the process get to sell their quilts to markets that James has developed and send their kids to school in the school there in Kathmandu. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have questions or comments. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org, or check us out on Facebook. There are pictures of all of today's studio guests sitting there with their bright, shining faces as they came to talk to us about the things they're doing in the world, which is something you've gotten into fairly deeply. Been 8 years now doing this. And you were describing the microfinance process before we went to the break.
Yeah. The participation in the making of quilts starts for Quilts for Kids starts just with a small loan. And the women are able to purchase the materials needed to make the quilts that they've made traditionally for centuries. And I market them in the West. And the money from the sale of those quilts puts kids in school. So after that initial $30 loan, the woman has to pay the loan back to me. It's a way of learning about lending and interest rates. And we have a little bank that we've set up to where once we've started to purchase quilts from the women, the money that they receive, if they don't need it for their families, they can just keep it in a bank, which is basically a safe place in my house, earn 5% interest, save money for their families. Generally, they are saving monies for marriages. When the daughters get married, there's a kind of dowry, and it can be quite expensive for this particular caste to throw marriages and marry their girls off. So we've created a bank where women can save money in a safe place, learn about saving, learn about interest, and learn about planning for the future.
Have there been a fair number of what I'll call here glottal stop moments in this experience where, you know, the thing that makes you go, where you've just learned something that you never conceived of in the society you came from?
That, you know, every day is one of the it's one of those moments. You know, I did the thing that most people from the West do, is that is we go over to another part of the world, a world that we see as sort of impoverished, and in many ways they are, and we think we're going to help everybody and change everything. It's absolutely the opposite. I'm the one that's benefiting from this project most of all, and learning things about myself and my view of the world and how to sort of be a better person, you can say, almost every day. And usually my teachers are under the age of 12.
They're teaching you as much as they're teaching you as much as they might learn from you. Yeah. You talked about interest. Now, certainly they make some interest back on the money that they're storing with you, but do you charge interest on the loans as well?
I do, just as a way of teaching them about what interest is. And these loans only generally last for about a month. So they're charged probably about 10 cents interest. But it's just a way in the door of teaching sort of basic economics. Somehow parlaying my 23 years on Wall Street into something usable. So I try to teach them a little bit about basic finances, banking, saving for the future, interest rates, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Grab your headphones. We have a call for you. Here is David in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to James Hopkins of Quilts for Kids Nepal. David, go ahead.
I do want to compliment you, James, on your work there, but I would also like to ask if you have had any interface with the Tibetan refugee community in Nepal. Nepal is a very important gateway for the Tibetans escaping tyranny from the Chinese, and also recently the Chinese have had increasing influence on the Nepalese government to forbid refugees escaping into Nepal.
Yeah, that's a great point. Absolutely. In fact, one of the original reasons that I went over to Nepal and to Tibet was because I was working on the political side of the sort of Free Tibet movement in Washington, D.C. So I'm well aware of exactly what you're talking about, and the increasing you can say oppression inside of Nepal. Of the Tibetan community is really something to be concerned about. Somehow that has continued even though the Tibetans have left occupied Tibet. In the neighborhood where I live, there are more than 40 Tibetan monasteries, and it is a Tibetan community. It's interesting that the communities, the Tibetan, Indian, Nepali communities are all living together, but they do stay separate in some ways. About the only way that this group of Indian migrants interacts with the Tibetan community is that many of the quilts that the women make are made from scraps of cloth that are used to make the lama's robes. There are two color themes that we see a lot of, and that's maroon and gold.
All right. Thanks for the question. I appreciate that. Give us a little more of a sketch about what life is like in Kathmandu generally, because you talked about the neighborhood and about the fact that the first time this child led you off to the part you hadn't seen before. But what's the rest of life like in Kathmandu? I mean, does it compare with any place Americans might recognize, or is it just a wholly different sort of lifestyle?
It is a wholly different type of lifestyle. In fact, the idea that we have generally of Kathmandu is not very close to what it is. We imagine a kind of Himalayan Shangri-La where it's sort of snowy and there are, kind of yogis living in caves nearby. It's actually a chaotic, polluted city of close to 3 million people now. There are usually anywhere from 6 to 16 hours a day with no electricity. Water is sometimes scarce. There are almost no facilities. The roads are in abysmal condition. It is one of the 10 poorest countries in the world, and Kathmandu is the sort of only main big city. What has happened is after 13 years of civil war that drove a large percentage of the population out of the agricultural areas into the Kathmandu city just for survival, the city can't handle the infrastructure of the city can't handle the population. So you end up with a lot of people who are in need of help. There are new problems now with, homeless kids, glue sniffing kids, begging kids, things like that, and that's what Quilts for Kids has sort of sought to help in some small way.
Have there been pressures to take on more through Quilts for Kids to help more people to expand the school? You mentioned you didn't want it to get that big.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I wanted to keep it really small. I just sort of thought, well, if I can't sell these quilts, I'm going to have to make sure these kids get an education myself so I can afford to, sponsor 4 of them. And then I remember going to 7 and thinking, oh, 7 is so many, And then the problem is there are a lot of kids and they all want to go to school and they're really cute. And they come up to you and they say, I want to go to school. And the parents request, and I can't say no. And so it's grown in spite of my desire to keep it small. And at a certain point, I just threw in the towel. And as I said, we have 51 kids. And when I go back next week, probably we'll have 55. So
it just continues to grow anyway.
Yes.
Let's talk about the school itself. Obviously, the families have to pay to get the kids in. $140 still for a year, is it?
It's approximately that. What I didn't realize is that as the kids progress through the grades, it gets more and more expensive. Also, I don't have kids myself, and I didn't realize realize how quickly kids wear out a pair of shoes or a school uniform. So, you know, we have a lot more expenses than I imagine, but a lot of very, very kind sponsors who make, you know, donations to the project. We still try to keep that original intent that the cost of one quilt sends a child to school for 1 year. And on average now, that's about $170. So these days, the quilts go for $170 each, no matter what they are. We try to keep it like that.
Is there any issue with the women having to work faster, harder to be able to crank out the quilts to keep the income coming?
No, it's been interesting. Now it's really a matter of pride in that community. The women are making lots of quilts. And in fact, there is a small group within that community, a kind of subcast, where quilt making isn't in their culture. Traditionally, they have been kind of a garbage-picking caste. From the Bihar state of India, one of the poorest states in India. Well, these women were watching the other women from Rajasthan and Punjab making quilts and earning a living and getting famous, you could say, in that community. And so they started copying them. And they started making these fantastic quilts out of just scraps that they pulled out of their, you know, their bags of clothes and cut up old clothing and they'd found around town, I guess. And it's a the stitching is all crooked, the colors are all crazy, and they're just sort of imitating what they'd seen. Well, I had a friend come from an art gallery in Kathmandu, wanting to do a show, and he said, "None of these fancy quilts, only these quilts from these garbage picking clan. They are fabulous." So, you know, there more and more the women in that community are really taking pride in being a quilt maker, holding a tradition that's gone on for years.
Grab your headphones again. We have another call for you. Paul in Grants Pass is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with James Hopkins from Quilts for Kids Nepal.
I've been in and out of this part of the program today, and I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to listen tonight. I want to compliment you for practicing compassion in the way it is meant to be practiced. And I'm pretty sure that's what the abbot was tricking you into doing.
That's a good point. Thanks for that, Paul. Tricking you into it. Do you think that's what happened?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure that's what happened. You know, as a kind of long-time practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism, that seems to be the job of the Lama or the Guru, to kind of trick your mind, really to pull the carpet out from underneath what you believe and what you know and what you understand and what you feel comfortable with, and to open up in very creative and clever ways the possibility that you can be different and that you can be better. And so, yes, I probably should go back and thank him for that. But yeah, it was one of many skillful things that we find in that community.
Yeah, interesting that Paul talked about this as compassion, the way it is meant to be practiced. And this is not a handout thing. It's we help you get off the ground with materials. You sell I'll help you sell the quilts. You bring in the money that sends the kids to school. Ultimately, you're just the pass through. You're the conduit in a sense. But yeah. I mean, did anybody not take well to this? You know, because if you're talking about a community of people who are generally beggars by trade. Through eons, were there people who just didn't particularly take to this, didn't like it, didn't like the idea of it?
I think for the first several years, people were skeptical in the community of what I was doing there. I was really the only light-skinned person down there for the most part, and certainly the men were skeptical. What are you doing with our women? Why is this only for women? And why is it? I was primarily interested in educating girls rather than boys. Statistically speaking, if you can educate girls, if you can educate women, cultures change more quickly. So that's what my intent was. So sure, a lot of suspicion, a lot of skepticism. I think what happened was after some time of me being there in that camp every day, usually twice a day for many years, everyone relaxed. And then money started flowing in nicely, and then the men sort of started to realize some of the benefit of the what their wives were doing. But you talk about compassion. You mentioned compassion earlier. This idea of going into a place and sort of imposing your sense of compassion, you know, I'm going to help you poor people. That was something that once I learned to drop that, things started to open up, not only for me, but for the project. And I think that also plays into the trust that was happening in the community. I never told women what kind of quilts to make. They were just naturally making what they always knew. I've actually never really advertised this project so much. It's simply been something that's grown by word of mouth, organically, just from friends and a network of compassionate and generous people around the world looking for a way to help. When I stopped saying no and stopped seeing myself as the guy who was going to change things, then everything started blossoming. And that kind of compassion and that kind of work in the world is, I think, the most effective way for everyone to benefit.
And it truly has blossomed. James Hopkins is the founder of Quilts for Kids Nepal. You can hear more from him tonight. He'll be appearing at Mix, M-I-X, on the plaza in Ashland at the downstairs location. 6 o'clock tonight, Mix in Ashland. More of James Hopkins. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
All right, good to have you.